Okay, so many people have asked us what possessed us to consider opening our farm up to the public in a very intimate way, and we just couldn't. We initially realized that our proximity to town was not a liability; it was an asset. And it could be turned into a revenue stream. And the other thing is, if you haven't like seen what goes viral on Facebook, it's baby goats. Baby goats are insanely charismatic and attractive to people, and people want, well, they really want to get in there and just snuggle with them. We don't really allow that because people could be carrying illnesses that could actually make them sick. So we have a no touch policy for our little ones. But just to even be able to see them is a huge draw, and it's a time of year that there's not a whole lot of other things going on in the farming realm, and it's beginning of spring and people are just really wanting to get out, and so we knew that was another asset that we had in addition to being close to a pretty substantial urban center. A population of about 100,000 is Champaign-Urbana, and the other asset that we had was back in 2007 I hired one of my former customers who had been a chef in town and who had been buying our cheese, and she had expressed to me that she was really getting tired of being in the restaurant business and really wanted to have a change of pace. So I said, oh, why don't you come and work for us and make cheese? And she's a Culinary Institute of America trained chef, and really embodied a lot of the values that we have in terms of eating seasonal and hyper local. And she did a lot of that kind of cooking in the restaurant. She was not an owner of that restaurant. She was the executive chef of that restaurant, and she just was burned out and her knees were bad, and she had long hours, and I mean, it's really kind of funny as I describe the things that she was trying to get away from because she went she went right back into, I mean, we didn't give her all the lowdown as to what it was really like to work on a creamery. But we were still relatively, this was before our major expansion, so we could, with somewhat of a straight face, say that it was not going to be as stressful as being a full-time executive chef. So those were the kind of the driving factors that moved us into this realm of food on a farm and opening ourselves up to the public. The other pivotal thing was a friend of ours from Chicago is extremely active in the slow food movement, and in fact, he nominated us to be delegates in 2006 to the Terra Madre, which I don't know. Are you guys familiar with slow food? And oh, okay, yeah. So that is a biannual festival of farmers and artisan food producers in the Piedmont region of Italy, and it was an incredible experience for us, mainly because we actually met some goat cheese producers in the Italian Alps and have since become friends with them. But anyway, this friend of ours knew Carlo Petrini, the founder of Slow Food, and it turned out that Carlo Petrini was coming to Chicago on a book tour, and he convinced his Carlo Petrini staff that he needed to visit a farm while he was on tour, and brought him and his translator to our farm, and we hosted a potluck in his honor, and that was our first farm meal that we didn't have a commercial kitchen at that time, and the quote that I have on the slide is he doesn't speak English, or at least he won't speak English, and our friend is fluent in Italian, and we had a wonderful meal with him. He is extremely charming and charismatic and quite a visionary. But at the end of the meal, and we also had some of our baby goats running around and chickens running around, and he, his comment towards the end of the meal was that if he believed in reincarnation, that he would want to come back as a goat on our farm, which we took as the ultimate compliment. That got our juices, our creative juices, flowing and thinking about possibly offering farm-to-table meals, not really fully understanding what was required in terms of all of the legal aspects and liability aspects. And we happened to invite who was to become our future head chef, Elisa DeMarco, to that event, and she was also a huge fan of his and was very inspired by his presence. So the other thing that happens in a creamery, there's a lot of time for talking, and you, 'cause you're waiting around for various things it's hurry up and wait in the cheese making process. So we would talk a lot about food. I like to eat, and I like good food. And we were constantly talking about, oh, nobody knows how great the produce is that's being grown here in central Illinois. Everybody just thinks it's just corn and soybeans, and there's no great local food to be had. And oh, wouldn't it be great if we showcased that food and made these meals, and people would come out to the farm and enjoy all this great food, and we can show them, yeah, you know, that was just grown like 5 miles away from here, and here's the farmer who grew it, and before we knew it, we were writing a grant proposal to the Frontera Farmer Foundation, which is a foundation that was started by Chef Rick Bayless of Frontera Grill in Chicago, to give small micro grants, not loans, but grants to farmers that wanted to do value-added ventures on their farm that serviced the Chicago food shed. And we fit those criteria. We submitted a proposal, and it was funded. And we had to, they don't give more than $12,000. That's the cap. And we knew that that was not going to be enough to actually put in a commercial kitchen. So we did raise, we got another loan, we put in a commercial kitchen in the space that was originally destined to be an on-farm market. In the summer of 2008, we hosted a trial dinner for family and friends. My mother, who's from Boston, flew out for that event. And it was July, I think it was. Really hot that day, incredibly hot. You can see how rosy-cheeked Elisa, our chef, is, and we're looking a little peaked in that picture. We set up a table on the lawn, beautiful white linen, gorgeous chairs, and where we live, it's really windy. We're on the prairie, and it's normally, even in the summer, it's really crazy windy, but that evening, all of a sudden, as the guests were sitting down to the table, the wind died, and it was probably in the mid-80s, maybe close to 90 degrees, with what felt like 90% humidity and no wind. And all of a sudden, we thought, oh, we never have mosquitoes here, nobody has to worry. All of a sudden, it was a feeding frenzy on people. Our guests were being literally eaten alive by mosquitoes, and it was hot and humid, and it was hard to overcome the discomfort until we started breaking out the bug spray. The other thing was Wes and I were the designated servers, and I had done a little bit of waitressing as a teenager, but I was not a trained server. Wes, did you? Wes hadn't even done even that. So we had part of the deal with feeding our family and friends was we had a little evaluation form, although not that they needed to do this anonymously. They were to give us candid feedback of the experience, and they let us have it. And Elisa, our chef, let us have it too. So here's what we learned is that that you obviously the food has to be great, and that you have to have enough. You can't let people go home hungry. It's not about like beautifully plated food that is so precious that people are leaving hungry, which often you find in fine dining restaurants. So we wanted to give them a lot of food, and that's not an issue with Elisa. She's Italian, and if anything, they leave without, you know, having to loosen their belt several notches. So that wasn't going to be a problem. The dining experience and the atmosphere and the assault from biting insects was huge. So much so that we decided we needed to build a platform, a wooden platform, to elevate the tables over the grass. And that really solved the problem of people's ankles being bitten to death by mosquitoes. The wind, you know, we can't really do a whole lot about that, but we do have on our website very clear what to expect when you're dining on a farm. Kind of, it is a farm. It's a working farm. Sometimes it smells. Sometimes there's insects. One year we had this pirate bug infestation that moved in when the soybeans were harvested. They eat aphids, and when the soybeans were harvested, the pirate bugs moved in to it happened to be on a dinner night, and were really attacking our guests, and that was not very pleasant. They were falling in the water glasses. It was like something from a grade B horror movie. And then the third valuable lesson was the value of trained wait staff. Our chef Elisa very quickly pulled us to the side after the meal and said, "You guys will never be servers. Your role will to be host and hostess, but you guys don't know what the hell you're doing, and you should not be servers, especially Wes."
So I got out of that.
So it was really critical for us to do this dry run with people that we knew would give us honest feedback, and we learned a lot of valuable things that then helped us make improvements so that when we opened our doors and actually started charging people to come eat at our farm, we knew that we could provide them with the kind of experience that merited the amount of money that they were about to fork over, or they had already forked over to us. So in August of 2008, we opened our doors. We had 5 dinners that season. They all sold out pretty fast. In the following year, we did 10. Those sold out also extremely fast. They are fashioned on a typical slow food concept where everyone dines at a communal long table. That was one of the things that Carlo Petrini had said, that everybody dines at one long table. You don't have individual tables where your guests sit at, you know, 2 or 4 covers for a table. The whole idea is that they're enjoying a meal together, that they have the opportunity to converse, meet people that they've never met before, and enjoy the meal communally. We also have, because we're offering so many courses and having intervals of upwards of 20 to 30 minutes between courses where people could actually walk around the farm and visit with the goats or what have you, the event lasts for 4 hours. So it's not like you're just going out to a restaurant. You're actually coming and having an experience. And we also gave people a tour of the farm, and that kind of became a signature aspect of the dinners. Each dinner had a theme, and so the menu was designed around a theme. It was also designed around what was going to be at its peak freshness and flavor that time of year to really accentuate what our region had to offer food-wise. If we were highlighting a particular farmer's products, be it vegetables or meats, we would invite that farmer as a guest, and they would talk to the guests about how they raised their products, and that was a really great way to introduce people in our area to farms that they may not have heard of before. We also, Elisa DeMarco became our resident farm chef initially part-time because we only did a certain number of these events. But we also invited guest chefs from Chicago who we already were selling our cheeses to. And I should add that since we are a dairy and a creamery, one of the courses was always a cheese course. And we would often feature either one particular cheese or a couple of different cheeses that we thought were tasting really great and talk about how that cheese was made. We got a few years into the process, we did get a liquor license. Then we let it lapse for a couple of years, and then last year we got a liquor license again. There's a lot of pros and cons associated with that, but our events have, from day one, always been BYOB, and they continue to be that way, even though we do have a liquor license now. The demand for a seat at the table was incredible. It was beyond what we could have ever imagined. And when we first started selling tickets to the dinners, when the season, we would put the entire season on the website and open up ticket sales, and within 5-10 minutes, almost the entire series was sold out. So fast that our web host at the time, and still is, Small Farm Central, which is a great host, I will add. But they could not handle the volume of traffic through our e-commerce. And actually, there were a lot of errors that happened because of that, people that actually made reservations that were never recorded. So we had to switch to a ticketing platform, that specializes in ticketing events like concerts and things, and that solved the glitches associated with the fast and high volume visiting of our website when tickets would go on sale. And we were getting a lot of inquiries about hosting private events. Every other day we were getting a call about doing a wedding and other kinds of businesses that wanted to host a dinner on the farm. So we started taking some of those private events. We never did weddings. Our chef had done weddings as a chef in her former life and had really put her foot down about doing weddings, because it's really not about the food at a wedding, typically. There's so many other emotional things going on, and she didn't want to have to get in the middle of that. Clearly, our original price per ticket was $85 a person, which is a lot. And we were selling out in 5 minutes, so we were like, So several people suggested that our price was too low. And so we decided a couple of years ago to, so we had $85 for our resident chef and $100 if it was a guest chef from Chicago. we decided a few years ago to raise the ticket price to a flat $125. That really slowed the rate at which ticket sales happened. Yes. Between 45 and 50 diners. Yeah. Originally, we were going to do 9 or 10 of these things. It was just going to be a little add-on, a value-added thing to get people more aware of our products. We were going to have 30 to 40 diners, and we wanted to be. It's hard when you have to turn people away, and we wanted to have the ability to seat more than 30 to 40 people, even though that was really the vision that our chef had originally had for this concept. So now we typically have 50 guests dining at the farm for each dinner. We felt like with the $125, we may have overshot the price point that people, $125 is a lot of money. It's not a lot of money in Chicago. I mean, people go to very high-end restaurants and will pay more than that for a 5-course meal. And we were rationalizing that it's not just about the food. The people are coming to have an experience, and part of that experience is the farm and meeting the farmers and such. However, we do feel like that price point excluded a lot of our customers. We still sell out. Even at $125, we sold out, but we were conscious of the folks that couldn't really access the meals because of that price. So actually this coming season we're lowering our price. And then last year our chef informed us that she really was going to be done at the end of last year's season. She has a young child who's in kindergarten and was feeling like all the things that she was trying to get away from being a full-time chef in the restaurant world had actually just transferred themselves onto being a farm chef. And we were also pushing her as we looked at the economics of having a farm kitchen and doing events like what we are doing, that to be able to justify paying a full-time staff, a kitchen staff, in addition to our other staff, that we really had to generate more business if we were going to do something like that. So December, we had our farewell dinner with her, and so we're using this change, which was really tough. I have to tell you, she's an amazing chef, and a lot of people throw around the concept or the words farm to table, and it's become very hip and very popular in the restaurant world. A lot of people love to put farmers' names on their menu. We can talk about that. I'm sure you guys probably have had this experience where they'll buy stuff from you and maybe put your name on their menu, and then all of a sudden they're not buying from you, but your name's still on their menu. Anyway, Alisa embodies the and lives and breathes the seasonal farm-to-table thing, and it's not every chef that really can cook that way. So it is. I won't deny that it is a huge loss for us. The other thing that has been really fun, though, is we've over the years grown more and more of our own produce and even our own animal protein to use in the dinners. And that second season that we had, Wes said, you know, okay, we're trying to promote how great our region is in terms of the food that we have available. What if we said, all right, you're gonna eat a meal, a 5-course meal, and everything that you're eating, or 90% of it, is gonna be from food grown within 100 yards of the dinner table. And that was the birth of our 100-yard dinner. Our first year, we raised guinea fowl. Anybody have had the wonderful pleasure of raising guinea fowl? Something else. They're really from another planet. But they are delicious. they just have no, they're very loud and they have no no gene for self-preservation. And I'll leave it at that. But we raised hogs on whey from our cheese-making process 1 year. We've raised ducks. That was a nightmare. We've raised turkeys. And our favorite poultry is the Freedom Ranger. Anybody raise Freedom Rangers? It's a great Freedom Rangers. It's a meat broiler bird. It's a design for foraging on pasture. They're delicious and really great chicken to raise. So it wasn't just about putting in the kitchen. It was having a garden and having our garden go from just our own personal garden to actually hiring a full-time horticulture person to manage the vegetables, because, you know, it wasn't much in the way of acreage footprint, but it's an enormous amount of work, and everything was managed organically. So in terms of the economics of it, it cost us between $35,000 and $40,000 to put this kitchen in, and that was partially subsidized by the grant that we got, and we bought pretty much new equipment. The biggest expense was the commercial hood that we had to put in, which it turned out was grossly oversized for the space of our kitchen. And be wary of the HVAC people. It's hard to find an honest HVAC person, at least in Illinois anyway, or Central Illinois. Maybe. We have, in terms of, once we were really doing enough business to essentially be able to hire our chef full time, an executive chef, a sous chef, two servers, a dishwasher. Once we got our liquor license, we actually had to add a third server to help pour wine. So that salary component has been between 30, sometimes up to 40% of the actual cost. Ingredients, because we're growing it ourselves, it's easy to say, well, that didn't cost anything, but in fact, it cost quite a bit. And when we actually looked at how much we were spending on someone to manage the garden, as well as the seed and the harvest and all that stuff, it's definitely something that you need to take into consideration. And of course, you know, part of the revenue that was generated is everything, all of our enterprises going to service our debt. General overhead of the electrical costs and all of the other basic costs associated with keeping the lights on. So our net profit is somewhere in the 5 to 10% range, and our chef kept telling us that's great. Most restaurants barely can have a margin at 5%, which is kind of a depressing thought. But that's apparently that's the reality in the restaurant world. The revenue was basically from the ticket sales. We would also once we had the liquor license, people did purchase wine and beer from us. But because we had created that BYO culture, it was hard to not continue to offer BYO as an option, because a lot of people would do their own investigating and make their own pairings. We could offer suggestions. But we had to develop other means of making people buy the alcohol that we were purchasing so that we could justify the cost of the liquor license. We also were able to sell other things, and as our reputation grew, people were interested in coming out to the farm for other food-related events. So we would do other kinds of things, and maybe not charge nearly as much. We definitely didn't charge as much But the hope was that then they would see that there's this great food being produced here, and they might consider coming to a dinner as a, you know, a life cycle celebration or something along those lines. So with the loss of our full-time chef, it's actually giving us an opportunity to really look hard at the economics of trying to run what was increasingly, because we always kept saying we're not a restaurant, but we were becoming a restaurant, because we had to become a restaurant so that we could generate enough revenue to actually pay our staff what they should make as trained professionals. And that was always a big source of friction. So we are going to just do events with guest chefs this year. We're partnering with a particular restaurant owner in Chicago to do a series of 6 dinners, and we'll also do some others with some other guest chefs. We're going to really cut back on the number of private events that we do, and we're going to try to offer more casual, lower price point kinds of events that will be by reservation, but not cost nearly as much. Because we found that we've got to create some opportunity for people to come out and eat food on the farm that isn't going to break their bank. So I'm going to move into the agritourism part of the presentation now. As we mentioned in our previous session, you cannot stop people from driving in your driveway. Wes was always threatening to put up a chain across the driveway, and they'd probably drive around that. It doesn't matter. We now have a sign that does open and close, and even when it's closed, they still drive up the driveway. We just couldn't fight it anymore. Wes was already giving tours associated with our farm dinners, and we had already opened up the farm to visitors in the spring to come see baby goats, and we were doing these farm breakfasts that I'll talk about that in a little bit. That also became a runaway train, and we started doing. Also, we were getting calls from schools that they wanted to bring kids out to school kids and nursery school kids and daycare kids. It came to a point where it was so disruptive. We were doing it for free initially. We just decided we've got to charge because our time is worth something. So we now charge $5 for children or students, even college-age students, and $8 for adults for an hour-long tour. And they always get a tasting of cheese and gelato at the end of the tour. Then a few years ago, we started thinking about who all is in our area that also has some cool things going on that are food related that we could partner with to do a tasting trail to highlight some of the other farms in our area that people may or may not have known about. So there's a winery not too far from us, and there's a really interesting game ranch not too far from us. So we did a three-legged tour that we called the Fork in the Road Tasting Trail, and that was very popular and very successful and helped all three of our businesses sell more products to the people on the tour. And the private events, what we call the Third Friday pop-up, I'll talk about that in a minute. All of these things can be considered agritourism, even if the emphasis is more on the food or the eating part of the experience versus the agriculture part of the experience. That's our granddaughter, by the way. We don't let people sit in the barn with the babies, but we do let our grandkids. The initial rationale for the breakfasts or bringing people out in the spring was, we're back in production. We don't have a farmer's market to go to. How can we get people to buy our products direct from us without the existence of a farmer's market. And a friend of ours who's a vegetable producer said, oh, you guys should just offer people breakfast. And we thought, oh, that's a good idea. So we started doing breakfast. The costs for the breakfasts are extremely affordable, a little bit more than what you would pay for not very good breakfast at McDonald's. And the turnout was astounding. We would get upwards of over 300 people on a Saturday morning for a three-hour period of time. We had traffic problems. We ended up having to put three people on parking cars. It was insane. But it is a short season. It's 6 weeks in the spring, 3 hours on a Saturday morning. But once we started keeping really good track of the cost of putting, and we had to have quite an army of staff to actually pull this off without having people wait for over an hour for their food. We just were totally caught off guard by the response. But once we really had the system, all the bugs in the system fixed, we realized pretty quickly that if the weather wasn't good or if there was some other event happening in town that Saturday morning, if we didn't hit over 300 people, that the profitability would either go into the red or be just at the break even. So we're really, really rethinking the whole concept of breakfast. It is something that the community loves. We're still going to do open house this year, but the food component, also because we don't have a chef anymore, the food component is going to be much streamlined. And it does help sell some cheese, but people are really there to see the babies and to eat a local food breakfast. That's really why they're there. So in the height of our season, we'll get as many as one to two organized tour groups a week to the farm. And we had enough school kid and preschool kid business that one of our staff became a part-time tour coordinator, and she handled all of the giving of the tours as well as getting the word out that we actually give these tours. We realized if we were going to pay somebody besides ourselves to do that we had to have certain targets of the amount of business that we needed to have per week to justify that. But we do get a variety of ages of children. We've had some STEM classes, the science-oriented programs where they've come out to do specific activities. Students from college classes, from a lactation biology class to food procurement class. We're even going to be hosting an art class this spring where they're going to come out to draw the goats. So there's lots of opportunities for that. And it's really fun with the little kids, especially because they have hypersensitive noses, and as soon as they walk into the milking parlor, they're all holding their nose. To me, I don't know what the problem is, but they're hilarious. And of course, they just even adults, all they want to do is stand there and pet the goats. So a few scenes from our tasting trail. They have the game ranch. They're wonderful people, really colorful, and they have a white bison, and he was a baby at the time, and they had him on a leash, and he was actually allowed to. They have a primitives antique shop on their farm, and he was allowed to go into the antique shop. It was literally like a bull in a china shop. But that was a huge draw. So the tour started at our farm. We did a full hour tour and then a little abbreviated tasting. Then they went to the game ranch, and then they ended at the winery where they'd get a tour of the inside, the vineyard and the winery. and a full tasting of the wines, and then we had the meats and or sausage and cheese for them to eat at the end of the tour. And that has been a really popular event, and we will continue to do that in the future. The third Friday pop-ups, this was a no reservations, 2 hours on one Friday a month. How am I doing? Okay. A very low-priced a la carte menu, live music, extremely family-friendly. Also, we could sell, opportunity to sell other farm products at the same time. The UPIC has really turned into a venture that can, we think, can be pretty profitable. We host the UPIC at the same time that we do a summer midweek open house where people can come with their families and get gelato by the scoop and buy some other farmers' products as well as our cheese and pick fruit when we have it available. And that is something that doesn't have a whole lot of staff overhead requirements. And if we have a lot of fruit, which we did last year and 2 years prior, it's great. People are really dying for that experience. We get so many calls, especially because our orchard is organic and managed organically. People want to be able to eat fruit that they know is going to be safe, especially if they have children. So the issues that anybody who brings people onto their farm have to consider is how do you want to control it? Because once you take that genie out of the box, especially if you are close to a population center, and you provide interesting and unique things for people to do, they're going to come. So there's liability issues, the kind of insurance that you have, and then how you, if you don't have an event that people purchase a ticket in advance, how do you know how many people are going to show up? And that's going to make the difference between whether you're in the black, in the red, or break even. We found with our pop-ups that the weather had a lot to do with it. If there was other competing events in town, that had a huge bearing on how many people showed up. And it's gotten us to think that we really, it's too risky to do no reservations kind of food-related events, because if we prepare too much food, then where does that food end up? And we have to either throw it out or give it to staff or whatever. We're now going into our 11th year as a creamery. The novelty of who we are and what we do has worn off, and the people that know about us through the word of mouth, et cetera, we're tapped into that community, and it's that community isn't necessarily growing organically, so we're having to work harder. And I'm going to talk about marketing in a few minutes. We're having to work harder to get the same numbers of people out, especially for a no reservations kind of event, to make it a profitable venture. And then, we're very sensitive to how much we charge. People in this country think that food should be as rock bottom cheap as possible. We've done a pretty good job of convincing people that actually know that there is a real cost for great food, but we are sensitive to people having to pay a lot for our high-end dinners. So we want to offer a variety of opportunities for people to eat food at our farm. The biosecurity aspect of it. Most people who raise livestock know that all it takes is someone to who might have been on somebody else's farm, or there might be a crossover kind of illness, especially with young animals that have weak immune system. So we have to pay a lot of attention to that, to the biosecurity aspect. And then, what are we? Are we a restaurant? Are we a farm? We really we we really struggle with the identity of who we are, first and foremost, as we try to accommodate customer interests and desires. And just the sheer economics of being a full-time food venue. It really is true that you don't make a lot of money in the restaurant business. And we have come to realize that we don't want to be a restaurant. We are first and foremost a working farm, and we want to be able to continue to offer food experiences, but we don't want to be a restaurant. Okay, so as we look at future trends, we're doing more and more farmer training. We've partnered with a nonprofit in our community that does beginning farmer training called the Land Connection, and our university. People are wanting experiences. This is like, as you look at market research, millennials, that's what they want, is experiences. They want to volunteer. They want to come out and eat. We definitely want to do more directed educational tours, because that way we're creating awareness in the future generation, and they do actually come and visit us at the farmers market. They drag their parents to the farmers market once they've been on a tour. Offering classes, we haven't done culinary classes yet, but we started offering cheese pairing classes, and I offered my first cheese making class this past fall, which was a day-long cheese making class. Okay, I'm gonna pause for a few questions before I go into my next session. Is that?
One quick comment about volunteers. So we're right next to the vet school, so we get a lot of vet students coming out to do all the volunteers for a lot of stuff. But during kidding season, because we do animal goats a lot ourselves, the customers and vet students volunteer, and we have about 60 people in our list that we coordinate for coming out to help. And that will clean up rooms and help along with stuff. So it's like this combination of getting people out to the parks and things and us getting some work done. So it's pretty hard to do otherwise.
Yeah, we actually have it. We have it. It's pretty tightly orchestrated. We don't have more than three volunteers at any given session. We have morning, noon, and evening feeding sessions. We always have a trained person to work with the volunteers. And we have repeat volunteers that are essentially non-paid staff that are really great, that can help with the people that don't know how to hold a bottle or recognize if somebody's not quite right yet.
So where's your vacation time?
We're here in beautiful Iowa.
Do you have no worries right now?
We have a really good newly hired
herd manager. I'm a worrier. I still worry.
Well, you worry,
yeah, we don't. We used to take warm weather vacations when we had off farm jobs, and
yeah.
We don't do that anymore. And it's funny because we're seasonal, but before you know it, there's going to be kids dropping. They always come earlier than you think. Always. Lois is shaking her head. And we're a lot better at preventing the bucks from getting to the does than we were when we first got started. The bucks stay far away from the does until October 1.
Just another comment.
Question?
What's the cheese pairing
class? So we often have people eat cheese with other things. Like sweet things like jams or honey, or savory things like pickles. And people We were actually starting to make our own accompaniments, and people are very easily overwhelmed when there's too many choices, and getting people to understand what goes well with certain types of cheese, pairings with wine, pairings with beer. Even we haven't done it yet, but we wanted to do a cheese and spirits pairing. And also, I did a kind of a sensory, how you get people to learn how to taste cheese and understand what they're tasting and develop a vocabulary for what they're tasting. Just like in the wine world, there's very elaborate vocabularies for how to describe wine. There is for cheese, too. But people are so intimidated. And when they go to a cheese counter, a good cheese counter, they really don't, you know, they're just kind of eyes glaze over, don't really even know what styles, you know, what is a Blumenrind cheese? What is a what is a natural rinded cheese? What is a washed curd cheese? They don't even know, you know, what the world of cheese is really all about.